I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome you to this focus on the revolution. This, I believe, represents a most significant event in the life of this seminary, because it is one of the few times in which the community has been called together to seek ways by which we can consider our role in the great revolution of which we are verily a part. As part of this effort to understand and to respond, we have a very distinguished panel. I have no need to introduce them to you. You know them all. Almira Kendricks will be here just a little later. The format for this focus will be as follows. The faculty members of the panel will speak first in this order. Dr. Anderson, followed by Dr. Michelson, followed by Dr. Key. And they will address themselves to the following considerations in whatever way they see fit. Their impressions of the march, which they were a part, why they went, and any implications which they can draw for our community and our communities. Almira and Charles will discuss the present situation with reference to SNCC and SLCC. We have to get used to these code words. Jim Sessions will add a theological exclamation point if he feels that this is necessary. In the second part of the focus will consist of questions and comments, hopefully directed in two directions, to the panel, and response and comment among the audience. We hope that perhaps we can get some of a dialogue going here today. We will close promptly at 3:50. Each person will have between 5 and 7 minutes in which to speak on the panel, and we can move quickly into the discussion area. At this point, I would like to call upon Jim Fowler to make a brief introductory statement of the purpose of our coming together this afternoon. Jim?
Thank you, Jim. You've noted a stress in what Jim said upon the word community, and that's the word I want to focus on for a moment here also. There are really two reasons for us to come together this afternoon, and the first reason I'm sure is obvious to each of you. Several members of our community who have recently been in Selma or Montgomery have returned, and they're going to report on some of the things that they saw, felt, and heard, and some of the things that they are able to perceive may occur in the future there. But the second reason is close to what Jim has mentioned already, the question of community. It has been striking that our response to the crises of the past 4 weeks, as well as the crises of a longer period in the past 2 or 3 years, have been largely in terms of individual responsibility. The questions I've heard in the past 4 weeks and the questions I've been asking myself, for the most part, have been these. What should I be doing in this crisis? What should I be doing in the struggle to attain civil rights for all our citizens? How should I order my hierarchy of responsibilities? I think that the kind of approach which this represents has been shown by the events of the past 4 weeks to be inadequate. Some of you are aware of a crisis which has developed in our own community as a result of certain individuals taking it upon themselves to represent our community and asking for, but not receiving, the official sanction of the student body. This grew out of a confusion which I don't want to labor all of us with now. It's one which has been deeply regretted by all of us who have been concerned in it. But it has had one positive value, I think, in that it has changed the focus on the question of responsibility from an individual question to one of community. What is our responsibility as a community? And by community, as this panel represents, and by as the presence of our faculty members represents, includes not just students, but all of us who are bound together in this institution, which we call a theological seminary. I think the advantages of approaching this question from a community focus or from a community point of view become obvious to us immediately. Resources and opportunities which were not available to us as individuals or as small groups of individuals are put at our disposal. No longer will we be forced to react on an ad hoc, piecemeal basis to crises as they arise. We can perhaps be prepared for the outbursts of Selma's and Jackson, Mississippi's, and others that are sure to come in the future. But over the long range, perhaps it can have other effects that are just as important or more important. It may permeate our whole curriculum and our whole understanding of ourselves as a theological seminary with a new concern. Our theology may take a new direction, a direction of involvement. These are some of the things that will result if we are able to engage this question as a community. And our deepest purpose for gathering here today and for asking you to be here is to begin together to wrestle with the question of what we, not only as individuals, but as a community, a body of Christ, should be doing in this crisis. Our speakers, as well as giving us information, will address themselves to this question, and we hope it will become a conversation and not speeches this afternoon, because many of you will have thoughts that will be of help to all of us, and we invite them. Thank you, Jim.
The subject of this assembly, focus on the revolution, reminds me of a sermon which Halford Luckock preached some years ago on the subject, sleeping through a revolution. He began by retelling the story of Rip Van Winkle, and he observes that there's one detail in that story which often escapes notice, namely that when Rip went up into the mountains to sleep, the inn on the little city on the Hudson had a picture of George III. And when he came back from his 20 years of slumber, that picture had been changed, and in its place was a picture of George Washington. So Dr. Luckock observed at the beginning of his sermon that the real point of that legend is not that Rip Van Winkle could sleep 20 years, because anybody could do that, but rather the point is that he was sleeping through a revolution. Surely it has been dawning upon all of us with increasing force that a vast revolution is sweeping through the world, and that America is caught up in that revolution, and so is the church. It is high time that we wake up to the fact that there is a social revolution. And therefore, it's my own conviction that the question is not whether this theological school should be involved in the revolution. We can't escape that. But rather the questions are how, that is to say, the form of involvement, and where, the place of involvement, and when, the time of involvement. It's been emphasized that the major qualification for our standing up here this afternoon to say a few words is that all of us have recently been down south, Selma or Montgomery or elsewhere. I'm not sure that that gives me much qualification to speak. As a matter of fact, I should like to disclaim saying that there is anything great or glorious about my going to Montgomery. For one thing, I didn't go as an individual. I went as an appointed member of the faculty of this theological school. The dean of our seminary, Dean Ranson, called us together in a special faculty session, and for a considerable time we debated the whole question. And the result of our vigorous discussion was the decision that this theological school, through its faculty, had a responsibility in this situation, and that therefore we would send a delegation of faculty to join with the students who would go. So I do not think of myself as going into that situation as an individual, but as a representative of the faculty. There's a real sense in which the whole faculty of this theological school should be gathered before you, insofar as this was a unanimous decision. Furthermore, I think that this act was all too safe and easy. Those of us who were there were reminded constantly of the protective powers that surrounded us, and we were aware that tension in that city was at perhaps an all-time minimum. In fact, no sooner did we arrive there and found ourselves in the midst of the scuffle to get on a bus and to join the march than Dr. Michelson would keep saying, well, he had never experienced such a relaxation of tension. Moreover, I feel that some of our students and faculty representatives in other situations have done things far more dangerous and far more difficult. As a matter of fact, if we were to carry out some kind of a demonstration here in Madison, it would be a far more difficult thing. So, as I say, I want to disclaim immediately any sense of grandeur or glory about going to Montgomery. This was an action in response to a telegram which we received last Saturday, in which Dr. Martin Luther King and the Southern Leadership Conference invited churchmen to participate in the march to Montgomery. It was a sense of churchmanship which some years ago prompted the faculty of this theological school to make a critical response to a report on the part of the Commission of 70. It was a sense of churchmanship which prompted the theological school last spring to send Dr. Randolph down to Jackson, Mississippi. And it was a sense of churchmanship which prompted the faculty to take its recent action. Well, what is the meaning of Montgomery? As far as I can tell from this point in my experience, there are three meanings which loom large in my own experience. First of all, that was a situation in which the conscience of the whole nation expressed itself. It was an all-American experience. In fact, never before have I experienced Americanism in its best expression. We had people from all over the country involved in that march, and I think increasingly there was the recognition that the lines which separate the states are only lines on a map. Wherever there is a grievance, anywhere in the United States, American citizens have the right to express their conscience. And thus our going there was not just a question of the rights of Negroes, but it was the right of American citizens to gather together in peaceful assembly and to express their own conscience. One of the most moving moments in that demonstration was that time when we all stood before the Capitol in Montgomery, atop of which was an Alabama flag, and just below it, the flag of the Confederacy. And in that moment, we were asked to sing the American anthem. and American flags of all sizes were waved. It was an overwhelming experience of what it means to be an American, involved in an expression of a fundamental American right. And secondly, I believe that was a situation in which the churches were gathered together in an expression of churchmanship. Too long have the churches of this country been sleeping through the revolution. And more and more in recent times, Protestants of various shades and Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and Jewish people have been coming together in a sense of a common expression of faith and obligation. There were times when we felt that that march was transformed from a kind of secular march into a religious pilgrimage. And at the very climax of Dr. King's address, I had the distinct feeling that he had shifted from an address into a sermon, that we were all standing not before a rostrum but before an altar, and that we were all listening to the appeal and experiencing the power of the gospel. And finally, I think that this experience was a demonstration of concern and moral support for those who are going to have to bear the brunt of this experience long after we departed. This was a matter which we discussed in the faculty before we went down. The aftermath of Montgomery and Selma will perhaps be even harder to bear for those who are actually living there, especially the Negroes, than the experiences themselves. We marched through the various strata of Alabama society as we left the field at St. Jude school. First, we went through the slums, the Negro slums, unpaved streets, no gutters, ramshackled houses, the kind of thing which is so characteristic of the Negro areas in the South so often. And then we moved into the poor white section and found a slight, ever so slight improvement. And then gradually we found ourselves going into the clean, white-controlled downtown area. And as we marched along, we saw the people out on the sides of the streets and on the porches. We wondered what this was meaning to them. What were their thoughts? We hoped that this would be a demonstration not so much against Wallace, and perhaps not so much against the whites who were in control, because we'd hoped that the moderate whites surely would sense the impact of all of this. But more than that, I believe that we hoped that this would be a demonstration of our concern and support for those, especially the Negroes, who will have to live and suffer in this situation patiently for an indefinite time to come. Well, these are some of the thoughts which crossed my mind as I participated in this experience. I'm glad that somebody else is going to add the theological exclamation point. This is a subject which interests all of us very deeply, and one which in which I would be very eager to discuss. I hope, however, that our involvement in situations of this kind can find us also involved in a common struggle together about the theological meaning of it all, and especially the import of the gospel in this time.
Personally, I've never felt more like an apostrophe. I have about three very small questions I'd like to raise, though I have no expectation of answering any of them, except possibly one. And I must say also that I'm greatly embarrassed about my involvement in this particular situation because, as Barney Anderson hinted, I enjoyed the whole thing so much. I think I'd much rather face the Southern whites than the Drew theologians, in class, that is. So I left my tape recorder and went off to Montgomery. But I had to confront myself with three questions. One, why did I go? And another, would I do it again? And a third, what will we all do when we have further occasions like this? And I assume this third is the big open question, which I know I'm not going to be able to answer, but which ought to occupy some in this discussion this afternoon. I think I went not because I expected to integrate Alabama, although I take pride in the fact that Dean Anderson and I did integrate a latrine. I couldn't have gone to integrate Alabama because that's a work of Sisyphus, and furthermore, it's something we haven't even completed in my own community of Morristown. So I might rather have stayed at home if that had been my motive. I think I went mainly to demonstrate on behalf of the freedom to demonstrate. I think that was the occasion that really called us there. And it's an important thing because the hope for the achievement of civil liberties everywhere will depend upon our continued freedom to demonstrate on behalf of just causes. Then I ask myself, why a theologian in a situation like that? Why not better at home with my books? And that's even harder for me to answer. One might say, I didn't go as a theologian, I went as a man. That's a bifurcation I don't accept. I pat my neighbor's dog as a theologian. I kiss my wife as a theologian. That's why theology is so crucial. And when I demonstrate on behalf of civil liberties, I do it as a theologian. As a matter of fact, I understand that the very existence of God is at stake in what men do in history. I think I got a little advanced clue to that last night when reading a poem by Frost, Robert Frost. I turned to speak to God about the world's despair, but to make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me. Don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there, at least not over half. I'm sure that one cannot do theology today without involving him in just such historical causes as the present civil rights enterprises give us the chance to do. But then would I do it again? That all depends on whether what we did there was like a baptism, which is unrepeatable because so indelible, or like pastoral calling, which is infinite in its demands upon us. And it seems quite obvious that while many aspects of this experience were like a baptism, as Dean Anderson has indicated, we will never be able to shake the memory of it from us. I have been baptized, we will say that over and over again, because of this experience. At the same time, we know that it was not just something that happened once, but it was an invitation to repeated acts of responsibility. So that leads me to my third question. What will we do when we have these repeated opportunities to leave our immediate responsibilities and go off in this way? I just don't know. And here's where I don't think I have any answer at all, but I'll be very eager to participate in the discussion about it. You see, one can't be a theologian without being involved in just such causes, but can one remain a theologian if all he does is get involved in such causes? That's the difficulty I face. Although, as I understand the situation in the first century church, as reported by the Apostle Paul, there was mainly one big opportunity for the expression of faith, the contest against legalism. And why couldn't it be just as true today that there's one main opportunity for the expression of faith, the contest against racial injustice? That could be the case. It could be so much the case that we'd rewrite our curriculum. We'd have a core curriculum in which everything we discussed would be built around the question of racial inequity. We would have civil rights as an epoch in Heilsgeschichte. And we'd have field work in which we would not just do everything in general under district superintendents, but we would do one thing in particular. We would train ourselves for efficiency in seeing to it that in every one of our communities, in these contiguous neighborhoods, civil liberties were increasingly respected. And we'd have a varsity team to go off to these remote places like Selma and Montgomery to carry on our contest on our behalf on the front lines. But in doing it all, we would have a sense that in fulfilling our human responsibilities, we were giving God a chance to be born again.
I suppose the question that was in my mind before the decision was made to go to Montgomery and has been in my mind for many months is not why should I go, but why have I not gone before? And I think I have had an answer for that. I had the sense that participation in these demonstrations, like almost any other human activity, was in part one with mixed motivations. And I think precisely because it had become somewhat fashionable for churchmen and theologians to participate, I was inclined to be unfashionable. Further, I suppose unconsciously, there had infiltrated into my mind something of what passes for logic in the argument that the problem should be settled on a local basis. And the people who live in these communities are the ones who have the primary responsibility to settle the difficulties, since they're the ones that are going to have to live with whatever settlement emerges. But it became increasingly apparent to me, following the brutalities at Selma and the reports of those who had been there for some days, that my assessment of the involvement of so-called outsiders was almost completely wrong. And that, in fact, we were outsiders not in relation to those who were oppressed, not in the least.
we were outsiders, rather, to those who were the oppressors. And there's a very real difference. It became apparent to me that those students and others like Chaplain Sessions, who had spent time living in Selma, living among the communities, living in the homes, were performing, if I may use the phrase, Dr. Michelson, pastoral duties in relation to these people. They were providing courage where courage was lacking. They were helping to focus with the perspective that only an outsider can bring, what the issues were and what some of the lines of attack might be. And above all, they were, in the most profound sense of the term, fellow sufferers with these people who were victimized by the oppression of the South. This estimate of the situation, and perhaps we're always pleased to be confirmed in our prejudices, but this estimate of the situation was much more deeply confirmed on the basis of the brief 24 hours which we spent in Montgomery, going to and from. It was impressed in the first place by the marching up the hill to the cradle of the Confederacy. The symbolism of that Capitol building at Montgomery was nothing short of overwhelming. Rather gracious, glistening white, lily white, one might say, a Capitol building with the flag of Alabama, the sovereign state of Alabama, and of the Confederacy flying above it, and no American flag in sight. Governor Wallace later said there was one around at the side that had been given by the children. Apparently it was accepted as a concession to the benighted children. But it wasn't worthwhile for it to be flown over the Capitol. At least in South Carolina, they put the American flag on top and the other two flags underneath, but not so in Alabama. But there we were, going up the avenue, as the newspapers have reported, the very one that Jefferson Davis wrote up when he was inaugurated. And it became apparent to me not only my Americanism, as Dr. Anderson has said, but the fact that in the most profound sense, we were no longer in America, at least no longer in a situation where America is in control. In a very real sense, we were in occupied territory. The whole ethos is aimed at undermining or eliminating what seems, in my judgment, to be the very essence, not only of democracy in general, but of the American form of democracy in particular. Unfortunately, there is wedded to this army of occupation, which rules Alabama, the church in many of its manifestations. This was graphically presented to us as we went by one of the more modern buildings downtown and saw there an enormous banner with this picture of Martin Luther King attending the Highland School in Tennessee with a banner over it, "Dr. King gets his training in a communist school." The building from which it was suspended was the Alabama Bible Society. But in the more positive and constructive way, as we passed through the Negro section coming into the city, I began to sense why it was important for us to be there, not simply for us as individuals, but for all of us to be there. There were out on their porches not merely rather solemn-faced, inscrutable persons, but elderly people, bedridden people, brought out on wheelchairs and beds to see the march go by. There were children lining the curbs, reaching out to touch the people as they went by. As we went down into the downtown district, there were chambermaids and service people, Negroes, leaning out of the windows of the hotels, almost literally reaching down to touch the marches went by. It was embarrassing because as the others have said, this was a very easy thing for us. A chartered plane, chartered buses to take us there, a few miles walk, and then chartered buses to take us back, and another chartered plane to bring us back here. We had a few inconveniences and nothing more. But here, even for us to be there, with our insensitivity and our lack of understanding, seemed in that moment to have a profound meaning and to be, if I may use a biblical term, a sign of deliverance. I regret we had no opportunity for conversation with white moderates or with others. I would hope that there would be opportunity for that. But I'm convinced that this notion of outsiders as interfering is a complete distortion. We are interfering with a tyrannical police state which exists in Alabama. But we would be shirking not only our American responsibility, but our Christian responsibility if we did not do so. Finally, what do we do here? I would like to think of this not simply in terms of our talking about this, and I hope we will. I hope that we will fulfill our task as a theological school in study and reflection. I would be happy to consider curricular revision along these lines. But I hope that we as individuals and as groups will become more involved in our own immediate community. One of the striking things after we reached the plaza in front of the Capitol was the complete freedom which Negroes and whites felt toward each other in that situation. The way in which lunches were shared and aching backs were rested against aching knees and so forth, literally helping one another and supporting one another in that situation. And I began to think how much freer I was with Negroes there than I likely would be with many Negroes in Madison or in Morris Township or Morristown or in Summit. And I wondered, as Dr. Anderson expressed a moment ago, whether I would be willing to demonstrate in a situation like that. I hope that we as a community will explore ways of political involvement and of direct community action in this community where we are placed. We cannot achieve transformation of the situation overnight here any more than we can there. But we need to realize that the heart of the movement lies in the person-to-person relationships which develop in the visitations, in the conversations that are there. And I hope we will avail ourselves and be sensitive to opportunities to act and live in these ways, in these communities where we are, in a way, outsiders vis-a-vis the Negro community.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Dr. Michelson, Dr. Key. It is my unpleasant duty to point to the clock. And I would just, with this word of caution, turn over to the students. I don't know if we're going to get our theological exclamation mark after all. So Charles Rinker is going to take over.
I'm going to quickly try to give you a few of the issues there, and then Elmore is going to put this in the context, hopefully, of larger issues in this country. There are basically two organizations that are working in Alabama at this point. One is SLIC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The other is SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, both of these organizations are interested in political participation, and there's been some discussion that we ought to try to distinguish between the two organizations and see what they're specifically interested in, where they have their arguments. I don't think we have time for that this afternoon, but I'll be glad to talk with you later about this if you're interested. They're both interested in political participation. They both realize that the march in and of itself did nothing to change the situation in Alabama. When we went down, we thought that the march would be a kind of a kickoff for a Freedom Democratic Party in Alabama. And it seems like the things there in Alabama, the situation, kind of came to a peak about 2 months before SCLC and the SNCC people there thought it would. They hadn't done a lot of their community organization they had planned to do. And we thought that this would be a good time for us to key in with this and try to help them some. Well, let me say a word about what the two organizations will be doing the rest of the spring, at least, and probably into the summer. SCLC will be attempting to get people out to the polls, get them registered, and they will be holding in a number of the communities in the Black Belt and in Montgomery adult citizenship classes to talk with the people about procedure and voting, how they go about registering, what this means, and then further in terms of community organization. SNCC will be working this spring and probably this summer to form a Freedom Democratic Party similar to the one that was formed in Mississippi. You might be interested, there was a lot of criticism levied at SNCC for their sending demonstrations down on Monday through Thursday there while the march was coming from Selma to Montgomery. A lot of questions were raised, why are you demonstrating and getting people put in jail? Talking with the leadership with SNCC, they explained this to me, at least. What they're trying to do is build a legal umbrella of federal intervention under which they can work this summer so that the kinds of things that happened last summer in Mississippi with the three civil rights workers won't happen, or at least this the possibility of this happening will be greatly lessened. So this is the this is what they're trying to do, keep putting pressure on the federal government to get federal intervention for protection to help these people who are going to be working in the community organizing the FDP. Now, we were down there, the MSM, about 100 people were there from Monday through Thursday, and we tried to do two things, or at least our project had two foci. One, simply for the people that were coming, we tried to do a task of what we were calling revolutionary nurture. Here we call it Christian education. trying to get into the homes of the community and listen to the people, see what they were saying, what they were feeling about all of this that was going on in Alabama. The second thing, we were trying to help the movement there by doing a number of things. One, recruiting people to get them out for the march on Thursday, to get them to the mass rallies and to hear some of the speeches and so forth. We were trying to talk to them about registering to vote, and then we were trying to listen to find contacts, grassroots contacts within the local community there for people who are going to be working after us, SCLC and SNCC, giving them local grassroots contacts for their work in community organization and building an FDP there. I think the basic thing that will change the situation there is what I've already mentioned before under the label of political participation. In Montgomery and, well, basically in Selma and the Black Belt counties there, of course, voter registration is a great problem. In the Montgomery area itself, which we became more familiar with in terms of the voting procedures and so forth, we found out that this wasn't quite so overt. At least the disenfranchisement wasn't so overt there. It was more in Montgomery itself in terms of economic reprisals, in terms of subtle things like the polls were all in white neighborhoods. The places to register were in white neighborhoods. The hours that you could register were from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. the work day, where you couldn't register before you went to work or after you went to work, this kind of thing. And then the deeper problem that I think this political participation will attempt to, and community organization will attempt to get at, is the fact that there is a great deal of apathy in Alabama about Negroes voting. For what do you have to vote for when you have a choice between Wallace and Jim Clark? Unless the community can organize, the Negro community there, unless there is some way for them to get some political power, then I think this is both what SNCC and what SCLC is working for. Then I think the march will not really be important if this follow-up doesn't go on. I was going to say a couple words about what we ought to do here in the Drew community. Maybe we can save that for discussion because time is running on. Just two comments, quick reflections about why we should be involved. One, I think, in terms of dealing with power structures, I think we in the Protestant Church have not really come to grips with the way power structures bind people and oftentimes are a very dehumanizing thing. And if they are dehumanizing, they need to be fought. The other is in terms of how we read God's action in these times. It seems to me that we must read God's action in terms of political realities, in terms of the disruptions toward which more human structures can be molded. Just one closing thing that Dr. Michelson will like, I'm sure, from his prayer seminar. As we were walking down the street in the march, this lady was standing on the porch and hollering at the top of her lungs, "Keep praying, brother, keep praying." So this is a good understanding of prayer.
They weren't in the seminar, obviously.
Mark. Well, I wrote this to be given before Charles, and so I hope you will remember that and then sort of put it ahead of what he said. Not that it's more important, but just that's the chronological order. Yesterday, Jim asked me if Charles and I would be able to give an analysis of the movement, and I must say before we begin that I simply can't do this because I don't know enough about the movement, but we'll share with you the few things that seem to me to be happening, perhaps, from my kind of, 7-day involvement in the movement. It seems to me that thing that is happening is a process of change. And the question is, what is our attitude toward change and how we are to be involved in it? The question is not whether we are interested in change for the sake of change, but whether change, and this the kind of change that we are seeing, doesn't have something to do with the process of humanization. If there are not changes afoot that will help each one of us somehow to be more human. And Paul Lehman has said that this is what God is doing in the world, helping humans to be more human. And so we try to understand change in that context. Perhaps it's easiest to say what this kind of change will not be in terms of the concrete political structures that Charles just spoke of. It will not be the kind of change that says that those people who are in the positions of power will give token concessions to those people who for so long have been powerless. This is not the kind of change we're talking about. So what is this kind of change? the key word in the movement, it would seem to be, is power. Power is something that we know about because other people have it, seemingly, and we feel it over our heads. This is the major way we understand it. Well, we need to understand what the source of the demand for power is. Those people who for so long have been completely without power are beginning to realize that power is the only way that their needs will be satisfied. The only way that they will be able to participate at all in society is to begin to develop some kind of a basic power. And so these people, be they black people or poor people, are beginning to understand, not simply from suggestions by outside agitators, etc., but simply by being faced with the fact that their backs are to the wall and that technological change is putting them farther and farther behind the affluent society, and if they don't begin to do something, organize in ways that make their words heard, nothing will happen to them. And so then, what is likely to happen is a change in the balance of power. The powerless will begin to have some degree of power. And so what are the immediate implications of this? Perhaps the immediate implications will be very frightening for us. Those of us who at least feel we're rather comfortable at the moment may all of a sudden discover that there are groups of people who are threatening our very existence. And so there will be a growth of kind of group consciousness. Black people will begin to understand that they are black people and that they have a certain power if they organize as black people. Poor people will begin to understand this same kind of reality. And this will be very frightening for comfortable middle-class people, especially because they begin to think, well, the only way other people get power is to take it away from me, and this is going to be scary. But this perhaps is something we have to learn to live with and deal with if we are going to survive. So this kind of thing is kind of the immediate implication. But if, to use a theological word, the eschatological implication of what this may mean is that eventually, if we can manage to live through the middle time, will be some kind of an open society where it will no longer be necessary to institute a group of racist policies in order to have integration, which is what we really have to do now. You know, we have to decide we're going to be integrated and then institute a racist policy to make sure it happens. Eventually, we may not have to do that. We may be able to make decisions on other bases, but for a while we're going to have to make decisions on particular group color bases. So this is what it looks like may be happening in terms of the issue of power, which is the central issue of the movement, not only in terms of the racial movement, but the whole economic, political structures and the tearing down of some structures and the building up of other structures that we face. Last week, John Bennett wrote an article in Christianity in Crisis on the church and power politics, and he said, the use of power may appear more bloody, but it is less coercive and less destructive than the power to prevent change. And it seems that at this time, the question that the movement is asking you and me is, which side are you on?
I'm staggered about how well my 3 points have already been made. So I think that my exclamation point will become a period or a dash, because I think it's much more important that we talk at this time. So,
we are met as a community. The question is, how are we going to respond? This is a unique opportunity which we have placed within our hands this afternoon to consider as a community how we are going to respond. And I'm wondering if the questions and comments can be on this level, because I think then it would fulfill the purpose for which we've come together this afternoon. You may address your questions to the chair, and if you wish to direct specifically which member of the panel you wish to speak to, the chair will direct you on to them. But I say this to facilitate our discussion. And this also would go for discussion within the group this afternoon. We have 20 minutes. If we stretch the point, we have 25 minutes. Jim Fay.
Dr. Anderson, when you mentioned that the future tension would be especially for the Negro, I wonder if we haven't been faced that our responsibility as white is to be responsible to the white community in the South. And I wonder if we shouldn't see the majority of our involvement to find out how we then could work now in the future with those moderate whites in the South. I wonder if this isn't where we should focus our involvement.
Well, that's a very good point, and I would be interested in hearing it discussed by those who are more familiar with the situation down there.
Amara, do you wish to respond to this?
Well, there seem to be two things, one of which is that in the kinds of situations that we've dealt with in the last 2 weeks, the presence of white people beside black people minimize the chances of violence. And that's a fact we have to deal with. The fact that there were white people there a couple of Tuesdays ago when we were in Selma meant that no police beat people over the head. It's as simple as that. And so there is a need for white people to fill that kind of a role. But there certainly is a need for white people to begin to deal with those people in the white community who, for a variety of reasons, have been reticent about speaking out. Well, we went over to Birmingham Southern on Thursday to talk to a friend of ours there, and the comment that she made was, "We know what you're doing, and we're glad you're there." You know, but she would never have gone to Selma or even to Montgomery to the march. So you see, people like this girl need to be sustained, and we have to begin to talk to them and find out what are the things that can be done to help bolster their position, if there are any things that can be done, you know.
One of the most impressive marches that I've read about lately was the march of those few whites, moderate whites, who that really took courage for them to express their identification and take a stand. I'm wondering what kind of discussions are being carried on in the South now in order to continue that type of demonstration.
Those, I believe there are about 60 of them in the whole state.
That's right.
They're called the Concerned Citizens of Alabama. And they were ferreted out by individual calling of staff members of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, whites obviously, and were banded together. That Tuesday march, in which there was no federal protection and they didn't know what the troops were going to do, they marched carrying signs saying, "I'm from Birmingham," or "I'm from Tuskegee," or "I'm from Tuscaloosa," which was really incredible. Mm-hmm. But that was the first time many of them had taken a step, the step of freedom, as King would put it, and was a brave deed. But this was personal contact. They were really talked into going there, and against their better judgment. But they will go again after that day. Their friends are puzzled within their own communities as to why they should take such an incredible step, and they are now going into homes and churches trying to explain their concern. In that way, this group may grow. But it's going to take that very slow process of one-to-one and one-to-a-small-group kind of conversation for that kind of white concern to be established, I think. And then these people were primarily from universities, college situations. White ministers to Negro congregations, etc. So they still did not get into the majority or middle class of Alabama. I think that will grow. It's going to take individual initiative. It'll be very slow.
Paul.
Dr. Anderson spoke in terms of American experience of churchmanship and concern for moral support. I was wondering if this kind of picture is compatible with Elmira's picture of political power structure. Do you see that the march, as you indicated, as just another pawn also in a power struggle?
Mm-hmm. Well, we did consider in our faculty discussion as to the question as to what type of political significance or impact the march itself would have. And I must admit, personally, I went into that situation realizing the possibility that it would have virtually no impact, and that the change in the power structure in the South would come through other channels. Now, I'm not, it may be that that's too pessimistic a view. I don't know what has come today, for instance, out of this interview with Governor Wallace. Maybe something will come out of it. But at any rate, granting that politically the march meant nothing, I still feel that it had these other dimensions of significance which made it well worthwhile for some of us to engage in it.
Can the church be involved in a bare political power struggle?
Well, what do you mean by a bare political power struggle?
Would you like to stand up, Paul, please?
Yeah. This morning in one of our classes, the professor put it this way. When we have a problem with injustice, there are two sides to it. One group who is the oppressor and through self-interest is trying to continue the oppression. One group who is oppressed and through self-interest is trying to eliminate the oppressor, mm-hmm. the oppression. I wonder if we give it this kind of analysis, if we scrape away some of the moral implications, if the church still has a responsibility to be involved with this. For instance, I think SNCC looks at the struggle very much this way. And I find even though Dr. King tries to give speeches a very strong overtone of religious and moral responsibility, that underneath is a strong current and feeling that this is a power struggle.
Could I just respond to this? I take strong exception to your dichotomy here. I think that to separate political issues and moral issues is not only impossible, but self-deceiving. Now, there's some political issues where the moral dimensions are not so readily apparent as they are in others. But I think it's soft-headed. I'm not accusing you of this at all. But I think it's soft-headed to assume that our job as churchmen is simply to nurture morality in some abstract sense.
I think there's been a tendency on the part of many of the church people involved in Alabama to have this feeling. This is why I'm raising this.
Yeah. Well, I would agree that that's been true, although I didn't sense that that was true of these Alabama churchmen who were here a few weeks ago. But it seems to me that Dr. King's power lies not in that he is able to gloss over a naked power struggle with a kind of veneer of religion and morality, but quite the other way around, that he's able to set an intense political and social and economic revolution in the context of theological and specifically Christian understanding. It seems to me that this was the power of his movement and the real clue to his success, and perhaps the clue to, or the indication of a constructive eschatological outcome that Elmira was speaking of a moment ago. So I hope we wouldn't get in this kind of dichotomy situation.
Moreover, if I may add a footnote to that, this so-called nonviolent movement is a movement which exercises power. That is, this is a strategy, it seems to me. And it's a strategy which is calculated to be effective in a certain area where there is at least a thin veneer of piety. And it may well be that in some other situation or in some other time, that kind of strategy would not work. And therefore, leaders like Dr. King would have to use other methods.
I heard that question in a little different way. Mm-hmm. Could I raise it
all right.
Again? It was raised dramatically for me when a group was deciding on who, in fact, was going to ride a bus to Montgomery. And the strategy was changed from this being a demonstrative trip to its being a trip to help begin an Alabama Freedom Democratic Party. And when that change was made by the group, some churchmen dropped out because they were quite willing to march in Alabama, but to get involved in the organization of a political power structure in Alabama raises a different question for them. That is the church involvement in politics. Now, and that's what I heard in this question. It makes a difference to march down the street than to be engaged in the power structure that's going to take to shift the society in Alabama, namely a Freedom Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. Now, does that make it a little different question?
No, that's the same question I heard.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I heard too.
I didn't hear your answer to it.
Well, I just think
it's not the question.
I think it's unrealistic if we assume that a struggle with the dimensions of this kind can be dealt with without some involvement in politics. And I think that's as true in the North as it is in the South, too.
Dr. Kelsey?
That is to say, here is a failure to realize the presence of the will of justice. Here is an affirmation that the struggle for justice is always the will to power, and that there is no presence of the will of justice, which would mean that it could not possibly be present in any third or fourth or fifth group. The will to justice becomes a historical impossibility.
Mr. Spraker.
Two questions I'd like to ask. First, did you feel that your position as an outsider, the reaction of the people in Alabama, was this an attempt at self-defense, or was it a real feeling that you were intruding? And the second question, is there as much opposition in Alabama to equal rights for the Negro as is given by impression by the governor and by Jim Clark and others? The vivid memory of 1957 in Clinton, Tennessee comes to me because I was there. And when the governor of Tennessee rolled the tanks in and said, "We will integrate," they did. And there was trouble, but it was overcome because someone in power did make a positive state. Do you get this feeling in Alabama that there is as resentment as is made claim for?
I suppose that question could only be answered by someone who has been in Alabama for over a period of time. Charles?
Probably not then either. I understand. I don't know. I don't have any figures or anything, but I understand that Wallace is gaining pretty much support. Now he's sort of at his peak in terms of popularity there. Now, I have no way of gauging this. anything. I think there is a lot that a strong leader, I think there is a something that a strong leader could do in bringing the people of Alabama along with him. But, well, I haven't seen Wallace do this, and I don't think he's going to with his eye on the Senate seat. I think probably, this is a hard question to answer because you might have a different concept of what the hostility is than I do, but I think there's definitely hostility there, and I think part of it is the realization of what Elmon and I were alluding to, that they're realizing that this is a power struggle. And the civil rights leaders are realizing this and talking in power terms now much more than they were, I would say, 2 years ago. Let me come up.
Jack?
Very definitely. Thank you very much, Jack, for sharing that concern with us. Are there any other concerns that should be raised? You may, Jim.
Very quick response to that. That's great, and I think that's the direction we should move. Well, I'd like to shift the emphasis a little bit and take what Elmira said seriously and what is heard in the movement is not social service, it's social change. And the church has too oft spent its time and energy in social service, that is putting band-aids on wounds while they bleed to death elsewhere, and needs to now commit itself to social change in our time. And so I take what you say very seriously, except just to shift the emphasis a little bit more towards concrete action in communities rather than service opportunities. The tutorial system project now is moving kind of out of tutorials a little bit, throwing more of its energy to block organization, for instance, and helping in rent strikes and so forth. So that would be a little different emphasis, it seems to me.
One question to Dr. Michelson. If we're going to
get into the business of midwifery and bring God to birth, how do we start? I mean, what would be the beginning if we're going to tackle something with this much greatness? Where do you see that we could begin as a community?
You mean for us?
For us.
I'm assuming it has begun, so that the question would really be, how do we continue and how do we avail ourselves of the opportunities that are now present to us in this particular situation? For that, I don't have the answer. I only say that this is the nature of our opportunity. It isn't just social service and it isn't just social change. It's the opportunity for theological rebirth, which just multiplies the relevance of our involvement to that extent. I would also like to underscore what seemed to me to be the consensus on this end, and which seemed, I'm sorry, Mr. Kelsey went, because it seemed to me his observation may have overshadowed the importance of what was said here. One of the things about incarnation, it seems to me, is that Christians have to learn to identify with causes which aren't necessarily pious causes, and maybe even to use as leverage for justice causes which don't have as their major concern justice. That's why it seems to me it's so exhilarating as a Christian to flirt with the more radical groups in the civil rights movement. Presence of slick and spick, I don't enjoy. Slick, snick, and spick. Spick stands for Society for the Promotion of Christian Knowledge. I'd like to get over into some of these other groups, for God's sake.
I think that we have drawn close to the end of our get-together this afternoon. I think that Dr. Michelson's comment that we are beginning. This was not called as a cure-all to any community ills that we may have, but I think that it has pointed us to various levels of involvement. I think that it is true to say that in our community there have been latent guilt feelings, latent hostility feelings. I believe that these feelings must be dealt with creatively. I believe that we have an opportunity, moving on from where we have started this afternoon. So I would just like to end this little get-together up in the air like this. Without trying to pull it together, I don't think that we can do it. Dennis, have you got a quick question? Because it is now
this is very
6 minutes.
You say this is the start, this get-together now. I'd like to have some kind of another community gathering like this or something to consider going on with our start.
What is the feeling of the group? Seems to me that you've made a point. And Ms. Morton, did you ever?
I was just wondering if, in addition to that, some kind of machinery could be set up whereby we could move as a body when certain crises emerge, rather than leaving it to individual persons or leaving it to the administration to have to call special meetings. If we could be involved all along in such a way that we could just move into it, I mean, even before we're called as
May I make a suggestion that out of this afternoon's gathering there is a committee appointed to present guidelines to another meeting of this community, at which time those guidelines could be discussed to answer the need which you have raised for us. May I further suggest that we have a ready-made structure under the Social Concerns Commission of the Student Council to work along with the Civil Rights Committee of the faculty. And I'm sure that this could be done with dispatch and with profit. Is this answer, would this be a...
Yes, I think I have a little sharper concern here, though, because while the social concerns, I think this is very fine, but we have an issue here that's going to be the primary issue of the church, it seems to me, in being the church, during most of our lifetime. And that it's an issue, while it is a complicated issue, it's involved with many other things, that we ought to deal head on, it seems, with this. And it ought to be sharp without the broader just social implications of the gospel, but really sharpened to this particular issue now.
Would you specifically make a suggestion as to how we could
get... I would like very much to.
Could you make it right now?
I made it.
Jim, we're not going to be able to.
Why don't we say we'll have a meeting next week?
Jim, why don't
why
we
not
meet next
lay
week?
Down maybe a couple of ground rules for this committee? First of all, what involvement in this community as a body centered upon, which would be brought before.
Next Tuesday. How about next Tuesday afternoon at this time, or at 3 o'clock rather than 2:30, at which time there will be some proposals for discussion. Nothing definite, but proposals for discussion leading to the point that Ms. Morton has said that we ought to go to. I think this is correct. I don't see how, though, in less time than a week, this can be done in a way that... And perhaps we could have these printed up in advance of the meeting and could circulate them in the halls, using the committees which Jim has pointed to as the... a group to raise the issues for the entire community to discuss.
And anyone, I would like to make an invitation here that anyone who is willing to serve on this committee should meet immediately following this gathering, and we can perhaps structure something there. We are forced by time and other responsibilities to draw this to a close. I want to thank you. I think that this is very significant in the life of our community, that you have gathered here, and I want to